Next case is case number 69400, Asian Store Market versus SF Investments. We have Mr. Eisenberg for the appellant, I believe it's Mr. Johnson for the meeting, and Ms. Gilbert for the respondent. Again, this will be a 20-minute each side argument. The meeting's going to have five minutes. Mr. Eisenberg will have 15, and Ms. Gilbert will have 20. Ready to proceed?
Yes.
And each of you would have an opportunity to reserve part of your 15 or part of your 5 for rebuttal, I would assume. Mr. Eisenberg.
Thank you, Your Honor. And may it please the Court, I'm Robert Eisenberg on behalf of the appellants, and Mr. Johnson will be arguing on behalf of Amicus, and I would like to reserve 5 minutes of my time, if I can, for rebuttal.
Sure.
In 2008, Congress created the Federal Housing Finance Agency to deal with a crisis in the secondary mortgage market, mainly involving Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. The federal agency was given authority to put Freddie or Fannie into conservatorship or receivership. And the law said that if the agency did put them into conservatorship or receivership, then their property would also become the property of the federal agency, and that property could not be subject to foreclosure. That's what we're referring to as the federal foreclosure bar. We contend that the federal foreclosure bar conflicts with Nevada's super priority lien statute if our Nevada statute is allowed to extinguish a first deed of trust in a Freddie Fed loan. Now, in this case, there are really three issues in this appeal: standing, commercial reasonableness, and notice. And I'd like to address standing first. NationStar was not the plaintiff here. SFR sued NationStar on a third-party complaint. NationStar teed up the federal foreclosure bar as an affirmative defense. And the district judge found that NationStar did not have standing to assert its own affirmative defense. The district judge didn't really explain its reasoning very well, but what the judge said was that he thought that Freddie and the federal agency needed to be parties in the case in order for NationStar to be able to raise the federal foreclosure bar. There is no reason why NationStar, as a beneficiary on the deed of trust, needed to have Freddie and the federal agency as parties in the case. That's just not what standing is. There were two separate bases for NationStar to have its own standing. It was a beneficiary in the deed of trust. It had a personal, direct, pecuniary interest.
Mr. Eisenberg, what did the judge say about the beneficiary status? If it was the beneficiary or owner of the deed of trust, why did the judge say that he didn't feel they had standing?
The judge didn't address that. The only thing the judge said was that NationStar didn't have standing because Freddie and the federal agency were not parties in the case.
Well, even if they were state chartered and if they're the beneficiary, wouldn't they have standing? Wouldn't that be your position?
Well, our position is that they had standing not just as the beneficiary, but they also had standing as a contractual servicers for Freddie. Okay. And they had the right to stand in Freddie's shoes and to assert Freddie's rights. Freddie is the owner of the loan. What the district judge seems to have bought into, because he said that he didn't think there was standing in the absence of the federal agency to Freddie, what he seems to have bought into was their argument that the federal preemption can only be asserted by a government agency and cannot be asserted by a private litigant.
Well, in this case, you were servicer of the loan, correct?
Pardon me?
You were servicer of the loan?
NationStar was a servicer.
Your name, and does that have any impact on whether or not you can have standing in this case. I'm trying to figure out exactly what servicer means. Assumedly that you're acting on behalf of Freddie and Fannie and trying to get those loans secured. And hey, can you explain that to me just a little bit?
Well, basically what a servicer does is service the loan, does the day-to-day functioning on the loan, opening the mail with the payment debt, dealing with the borrower when the borrower calls.
On behalf of?
On behalf of whoever owns the loan, which in this case was Freddie. And at the end, if the borrower defaults, the servicer can, under this court's old mediation program, the court has recognized that servicers can show up at the mediation to negotiate on behalf of the owner of the loan. And they can do everything up to foreclosing on the loan. And those obligations and rights as a servicer are set forth not only in the deed of trust in this case, which was originally MERS, and then it was assigned to Bank of America and then assigned to NationStar. But those rights and obligations are in the deed of trust and in the contractual obligations that NationStar had with Freddie. And that's in the record as well. So NationStar,
it wasn't the beneficiary was Freddie Mac. They're the ones that were entitled to the payments, and NationStar was just handling the processing for them. Is that correct?
NationStar is the named beneficiary in the deed of trust. Okay. Freddie was the owner of the loan. In the secondary market, Freddie and Fannie purchase loans, and then the original lenders get that money. They can pump it back into the mortgage market.
Right. Mr. Eisenberg, I'm sorry, did you finish your answer?
Yes, sir.
Is it clear from the record that Freddie Mac or FHFA owned the loan and that NationStar had a contract as their agent?
Yes, it is, Your Honor, and in fact...
Don't take your time now, but I would like to get the record cites on that. There seems to be some dispute about that fact.
I can show you exactly where it is in the record. SFR put the entire deposition of NationStar's 30B6 record, 30B6 witness, into the record. It's on Volume 2 of the Joint Appendix, starting at page 355. There are at least 5, 6, maybe 7 times when that 30B6 witness says she looked at all of NationStar's records, she's familiar with the records, they were compiled by a department within NationStar that's very competent, that those records show, number one, this was a Freddie loan, number two, that NationStar was the servicer for Freddie on this loan, and number three, that NationStar had contractual obligations to Freddie, including the obligation to protect the lien.
Well, that's something the judge never addressed specifically. Basically, from my understanding, the judge simply said that Freddie Mac or FHFA needed to be a party to the action.
That's right. The judge never addressed those things. And I think when the judge made that comment, the judge was apparently believing the argument that a private litigant cannot raise a supremacy issue, which is simply wrong under the Armstrong, U.S. Supreme Court decision Armstrong, and this court's decision in Munoz versus Branch Banking. And so the issues really are separate. The judge never reached the issue of whether this was a Freddie loan, whether NationStar was Freddie's servicer, or whether NationStar had authority to act on behalf whether NationStar had authority to act on behalf of Freddie on this loan, including protecting the security interests. That's what Freddie and Fannie buy. They buy secured loans, secured by deeds of trust, and they hire servicers to do the day-to-day activities.
Assuming this court were to conclude that the 30B6 deposition testimony establishes in the record that Freddie Mac or FHFA owned the loan and that NationStar was their servicer, then you would urge the court to reach the merits on the foreclosure bar.
Correct. And I respectfully suggest to you that the evidence is so clear on that point. It's uncontradicted. There was no evidence whatsoever that this was not a Freddie loan, that NationStar wasn't the servicer, that NationStar didn't have authority to protect the lien here. That it was so clear the court should have granted NationStar's summary judgment. But at the very least, the court should have held that NationStar had standing to assert its affirmative defense.
What is your position on the issue of commercial reasonableness? You heard some of the discussion. I saw you sitting in the audience in the argument before. Would you comment on that point and how this court should approach that issue?
I can, and it was interesting to sit and listen to an argument dealing with an issue that involved my case. It was difficult for me to hear counsel's argument when I was behind her, but the way I look at Shep...
She disagrees with you, I bet.
I'm sorry?
She disagrees with you, I bet.
I wouldn't presume to tell you, Justice Pickering, what you meant in Shadowwood, but I can tell you the way I read it. I read Shadowwood as kind of establishing a sliding scale approach, that if there is gross unreasonableness or gross disparity between the value of the property and the sales price, then that will trigger a further inquiry. And the larger the disparity, then it seems to me that the more scrutiny should be given to other factors. And the restatement establishes kind of a bar of 20%. This court, whether you mentioned the 20%, but you didn't really adopt it as a...
It would have been dictum in that case.
But in this case, we have 8%. So in this case, if you use the standard of grossly unreasonable judicial conscience, whatever standard you use, it would apply here.
But further to that, and I don't disagree with anything you've said. It's a very good articulation. Is there a difference between commercial unreasonableness and what you just described? People are invoking commercial reasonableness as if it applied in the foreclosure setting and signifies something different than unfairness, oppression, and fraud, with gross unreasonableness of price being part of the mix.
As I understand Shadowwood, the grossly unreasonable price triggers the further inquiry. The further inquiry is to whether there was fraud, oppression, or unreasonableness. And that inquiry would include things such as the adequacy of notice, confusion regarding prices, all of the things that Shadowwood recognized as justifying denial of summary judgment.
But you're not contending by the invocation of commercial reasonableness doctrine that the UCC doctrine applies straight across into the foreclosure setting, or are you?
Well, like I said, the way I read Shadowwood is that the grossly unreasonable price triggers the commercial reasonableness inquiry into whether there...
Okay, I see what you're saying. So you really aren't adopting the use, you're not trying to transplant the UCC doctrine into the foreclosure setting.
Well, as I understand it, the HOA foreclosure statutes have a good faith requirement.
Yep.
Part of the good faith requirement is commercial reasonableness. And there's no court that I'm aware of that said commercial reasonableness does not apply in a foreclosure setting, but even a super priority setting.
Well, stated a different way, shouldn't we apply the standard adopted in Long in making that additional inquiry?
Standards adopted?
Adopted in Long?
If I'm remembering Long correctly, that was kind of the predecessor to Shadowwood, and I think Shadowwood being the more recent approach. Shadowwood didn't, as I read it, didn't establish anything new. It simply clarified the old law regarding commercial unreasonableness. And by the way, I'd point out that the Shadowwood opinion, which dealt with commercial reasonableness, deed foreclosure, foreclosure deed recitals, and bona fide purchases for value. That decision came out 2 months after the district court's decision in this case. So the district judge didn't have the benefit of Shadowwood when he made the decisions in this case.
The question, though, even in your theory, how did you put forth in reasonableness question to the court?
Did we set it?
How was it put before the court?
Well, it was part of the motions for summary judgment.
I understand it was part, but what specifically was alleged in terms of unreasonableness?
They argued that, for one thing, NationStar never got any notice of the sales, didn't get any of the three notices, even though it was a recorded beneficiary of the deed of trust, that the notices themselves were defective because they set up three different amounts, and that none of the notices indicated that any amounts were super priority lien amounts. The notice also, the statute requires the notice to give the amount of the assessments and liens as of the proposed date of the sale, and the notice didn't do that. So there were several attacks on the notices that were teed up, so to speak, as in establishing unreasonableness. I see that I have about a half a minute of my 5 minutes left, so I'd like to reserve the rest of my time.
I'm going to give you 2 minutes, and you've just picked up another 2 minutes to 22 minutes. We'll see how we do with the amici. You may end up with a half hour if this is over, the way the questions are being asked. So we'll have Mr. Johnson now for the amici, and we set the clock at 5 minutes. We'll see what happens with your 5 minutes as to what Ms. Gilbert will obtain from you.
Well, thank you, Chief Justice Cherry and Associate Justices. I'm grateful for the opportunity to address the court. I appreciate you granting my client, Federal Housing Finance Agency, leave to argue today. I would like to reserve one of my 5 minutes for rebuttal with the court's permission. In my 4 minutes, I'm happy to address any inquiries from the court, but I'd like to address three topics on my own. Number one, why am I here? Number two, what is at stake? And number three, what should we make of SFR's arguments on the standing question? Why am I here? Well, the question before the court is whether NationStar, as Freddie Mac's contractually authorized servicer, can invoke the statutory protection Congress granted the Freddie Mac conservatorship that my friend, Mr. Eisenberg, capably recounted to the court to protect that lien on Freddie Mac's behalf. I'm here because that's important to my client, the Federal Housing Finance Agency. My client regulates entities that are active in the secondary market, and the role of servicers and their ability to represent the interests of the owner of the loan is the foundation of the secondary market. On an efficiency basis, it allows specialization. It allows the enterprises who are excellent at financial operations to contract down the practical aspects of loan ownership and to let someone else who is good at representing loan owners' interests in all of the jurisdictions around the country do that on their behalf. It is what makes the secondary market work. That's recognized in the restatement. Section 5.4, comments C and E, specifically encourage courts to be vigorous in finding that kind of relationship so that servicers and other contractually authorized representatives can effectively represent the interests of the loan owner. It's important to my client as conservator of Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae also. You know, the FHFA is a small federal agency. As conservator, it's sort of the captain of the ship, right? It charts the course. It can't pull all the oars itself. There are hundreds of these cases involving Freddie Mac or Fannie Mae loans in Nevada. And that Nevada HOA litigation is only a small part of the agency's litigation load. If the agency had to be directly involved in every case that implicates any of its statutory protections as a conservator, it could hardly get any of its other important work done. And remember, the conservatorship was created at a moment of extreme crisis to really save the nation's housing market and thereby stabilize the overall economy. So it is very difficult to overstate the importance of this issue, not only to my client, but also to the economy at large. What is at stake here? Well, SFR seeks really a seismic shift in settled law. It is settled law that servicers are real parties in interest that have standing to protect the interests of the loan, of the owners of the loan in litigation related to the loan. We can look at the Greer case, which is an 11th Circuit federal case from the 2000s, but it looks back to cases all the way back decades, into the 60s, 50 years ago, They cite cases recognizing that servicers are real parties in interest with authority to represent the interests of the loan owner in litigation.
Sorry to interrupt you, but did anyone on the other side make an objection under Rule 17 that they weren't the real party in interest and you needed to be substituted or brought in?
I think at the oral argument, the issue was raised. There was discussion between the parties and the district court. And then
but the Rule 17 machinery was never set in motion by writing or not?
I didn't see any order of the record, Your Honor. Certainly no one tried to implead Freddie Mac or FHFA. We weren't served with anything.
And so, you keep going on.
So this case is about the servicer's ability to act as the contractually authorized representative. We look at Greer. We look at this court's decision in Montague, which involves MERS, but it applies the same doctrine, that the loan owner's contractually authorized representative can represent the loan owner's interests. So you look at the McKeever case from the Sixth Circuit. That's in our Notice of Supplemental Authority. That's a TILA case. It just shows it's not all about foreclosure. It's about any kind of cause of action that relates to the loan. The servicer has standing to represent the loan owner's interests. Cases just like this one, the Beal Bank case, applying a federal property protection statute that applies to the FDIC, not FHFA. The Santa Coy Bay Snapdragon versus Flagstar case applies the same statutory protection here. The same, and holds that the servicer in that case has standing. Now, Ms. Gilbert would likely say, well, what about the Pelagian case? Didn't Chief Judge Navarro come out the other way? The decision says what it says, but what's important about that decision is, number one, issue was never briefed by the parties. Number two, the denial of summary judgment is without prejudice. So the court is anticipating the parties coming back and actually briefing the issue and reciting the subtle law that I've described. Now, what about the issues that SFR raises? First, they say, well, the statute should say that servicers can represent the interests of the loan owner in invoking the property protection clause, the federal foreclosure bar. Well, Beal Bank doesn't say that. This court's decision in Munoz says that, hey, the interest in the federal statute, companion statute, governs FDIC receiverships. That alone is enough to allow the acquirer, branch banking, to make a preemption argument. With the court's
You used up your time. I'm sorry.
Thank
Please
you.
Be seated. I'm going to give you a minute for a rebuttal, and now you're up to 23 minutes.
Thanks.
So here's what we have. Mr. Eisenberg, we have 2.5 minutes rebuttal. You'll have a minute in rebuttal, and you'll have 23 minutes, Mr. Gilbert.
Ms. Gilbert? Sorry, it's me. Why isn't the unrebutted testimony of the 36B witness sufficient to establish the relationship between Freddie and NationStar?
I think, Your Honor, first of all, you have all of the facts for that about ownership would be in their possession. And what we have is a self-serving testimony of a 30B6 witness who states that there are documents that prove this, that she looked at her system and yet provided none of the documents to support her evidence. And we ask, if you look on page 369 of the record, Ms. Ebron asked for the pooling and servicing agreement.
Well, does it really even matter? Because the district court found that the servicer didn't have standing in any of it.
You're right, Your Honor. And I think the district court was correct in this. But if I can finish answering, I think that it would not be enough. In fact, if you look at all of the cases cited by the bank, NationStar, in their briefs about standing and being able to support FHFA and Freddie's or Fannie's interest, they have testimony from the enterprises, they have copies of contracts, they have printouts from the Fannie Mae website in these various cases. None of them relied solely on the testimony of a 30B6 witness who failed to provide any documentary evidence to support the testimony. That would why that there's no evidence. And it's belied by the recorded documents. You have a deed of trust. The first assignment from MERS is to BANA, Bank of America, and Bank of America for both the deed of trust and the note. And the assignment to NationStar is merely of the note. I mean, of the deed of trust, not the note. So there is no evidence. It's belied. You have contradiction. This is why the district court never reached the issue because they said that the servicer doesn't have standing. And
was there a document request or a subpoena as part of the 30B6 deposition requiring the production of those documents?
Yes, Your Honor. We asked for documents supporting any other entity that had an interest in the note. We asked at the deposition for a copy of the pooling and servicing agreement, which would have, you would anticipate, NationStar as the servicer and the loan listed somewhere in there. There is no evidence that this servicer and this loan even go together. So yes, there were requests for this information. It was never provided. As to standing, there's a difference between having standing to be in a case, and NationStar admits it had its own interest in the deed of trust. It's separate and apart from the interest of the agency or Freddie. And the district court truly never even looked at and impacted FHFA's, the agency's, or Freddie's interest. Let's take a look at what they actually said. We have a whole parade of horribles about how affirmance is going to harm the agency and its ability to do its job. But let's put this in perspective in this order. What you have is an order that says nothing herein shall be construed to prohibit Freddie or the agency from asserting in an appropriate action that 12 U.S.C. 4617J3 preempts NRS 116. NationStar's interest in the property was extinguished by the association foreclosure sale. NationStar's interest, and they said they had a separate interest. So this doesn't even go to the agency's interest. They're not impacted by this order. But the standing issue, it is important. Did they have standing to be there? The reason is standing to be able to work under state law or federal bankruptcy law and be able to assert someone's interest is one thing. The ability to come on a federal statute to be able to preempt sovereign state law is a whole different issue. And that's what we have here. What you have is NationStar wanting to assert 4617J3, statute of interest here, 4617J3 to be able to preempt state law. They don't have standing under Armstrong. They say that the bank claims that it has standing under Armstrong because it allows private citizens to come before the court and use federal law. What Armstrong says is that when courts, it instructs courts what to do. The Supremacy Clause instructs courts what to do when state and federal law clash, comma, but is silent regarding who may enforce federal laws in court and in what circumstances they may do so. That's what was missing in the Thunder Properties case by Judge Jones that the bank relies on. Armstrong gave three examples. You can't convict a defendant of violating state statute and federal law prohibits. Courts will not impose liability on a defendant under state law for conduct federal law requires. That's the case that the bank relies on. And if federal law immunizes an individual from state regulation, then the courts can enjoin the regulation. That isn't any of these cases. This is who can invoke. Who can invoke 4617J3 to preempt state law? Congress.
Well, looking at paragraph 12 of the court's findings here, it appears as though the court rejected the notion that a servicer can do that.
Correct, Your Honor.
As a matter of law.
Correct, Your Honor.
Because it does indicate that although there's a dispute about whether Freddie Mac or FHFA has an interest in the deed of trust or the loan, the court goes on to say, even if they did, NationStar is not the proper party to raise the defense.
Correct, Your Honor. And here's why. Okay. Is if you're going to look at Armstrong to look to see if the servicer can invoke federal law, in other words, the Supremacy Clause silent, as to who may enforce federal law in court and in what circumstances. So what do you look to? The text of the statute that's being invoked. HERA created the agency. HERA, Congress created HERA. Congress, and Congress alone, gives power to the agency. The agency doesn't exist without HERA and without Congress, and its authority and powers don't exist unless they're given to them by Congress. 4617J3 states, no property of the agency shall be subject to foreclosure without the consent of the agency. What it does not say is no property of NationStar. Here, the district court order got rid of property of NationStar, not of the agency.
So your point is, even if they had, I mean, are you arguing that even if they had produced the pooling agreement and produced everything you wanted and their 30B6 deposition was unassailable, they still would have had to have bring in the agency in order to raise the preemption issue? Is that what you're arguing?
Yes, Your Honor. And the reason for that is because 4617J1, which is says where 4617J applies, all the subsections of 4617J applies, imposes a condition precedent. 4617J applies with respect to the agency. To the agency. In any case in which the agency is acting as a conservator or receiver. This is not a case in which the agency is acting as a conservator or receiver. The agency isn't in this case. It is a condition precedent. The powers given by Congress were to the agency, not to NationStar. And the agency cannot...
So the agency can't act through an agent?
Yeah, the Congress gave them the ability to contract. But there's no evidence of a contract between the agency and NationStar.
But if there were...
But that isn't before this court. We don't even have evidence of contract between NationStar and Freddie, let alone the agency and NationStar. So that hypothetical isn't before the court. But if they were, we would be... If the agency were in the case, or if the agency had a contract with NationStar, we would have whole different arguments, whole different briefing, and whole different defenses by SFR. To 4617J3, which are fully briefed before the Ninth Circuit. But even the agency has taken an alternative position to what it's taking here today. In the MERS multi-district litigation, it asked to intervene. It knows how to intervene in cases. It's done it dozens of times. It's done it, I don't know how many times, in the federal district court here to raise and to provide unique statutory defenses that are not available to any other party in the case. In that litigation, Freddie or Fannie was a party to the case, and the banks are all party to the case. Unique statutory defenses, because Congress gives only the agency the power. The agency recognized that when it promulgated through proper means a CFR, a regulation, that gives it the exclusive authority to investigate and prosecute claims of any type, or the ability there to delegate to the management of Freddie or Fannie the authority to investigate and prosecute claims. But that did that through the CFR process. There's nothing here to show a relationship, a direct relationship or contract between the agency and NationStar. There's a dearth of evidence between NationStar and Freddie. So that's the problem here. But you have to keep going back to the statute and what the statute does and what the statute says. And the problem here is that that Congress decides who has the authority, and the agency doesn't get to say, hey, we're small, and so we can't do this. They have proven time and time again, not only can they do.
But you acknowledge, don't you, that 12 CFR 1237-3A-8 allows the FHFA to contract for assistance in fulfilling its functions, activities, actions, and duties of the agency as a conservator?
I do, Your Honor. And again, there is no evidence.
So what's the basis for arguing that if there is a contract between NationStar and FHFA, that it cannot assert the foreclosure bar on behalf of its principal.
What I'm saying is that there is no contract. There's no evidence of a contract between the agency and NationStar.
Well, I understood your response to Justice Pickering to be it didn't matter.
No,
your
no,
contention
no.
was that it didn't matter. Did I misunderstand?
Oh, I'm sorry, Your Honor. If I misspoke, I apologize. Well,
maybe
if
I
there
misspoke,
was an actual contract,
but that's what I understood.
I apologize,
saying.
Your Honor, and I thank you for.
This is
for
why
that
I referenced. This is why I referenced 12 of the court's finding, because the court's finding says, even if they did, NationStar could still not assert the defense, and this regulation seems to suggest that the agency can retain a contractor who could then assert this defense.
I think what we have, Your Honor, and let me see if I can clear this up quickly. There is no evidence. The district court found that there was a dispute or something between Freddie, a dispute as to whether Freddie had a contract with NationStar. There was nothing in there about whether NationStar had a contract with the agency itself.
Well, the
but if there were a contract from the agency to Freddie to NationStar, what's your analysis of this issue?
My analysis of this issue is that there isn't. There is no contract between FHFA and Freddie.
Well,
there's no evidence of any contract.
But did the court preclude any information as to that by the first step of saying
it doesn't matter if there is or isn't. Yeah.
Because they're not, if they brought some kind of actual contract from NationStar to the agency.
But it seems we didn't get that far because the court precluded it.
And again, this was summary judgment and they brought no evidence of it.
But Ms. Stewart,
and they didn't claim it. And to be sure, the agency doesn't claim it today. And if you look at the case, I'm sorry.
No, no, go on.
If you look at the case by Chief Judge Navarro, so they cite the banker, FHFA, cites to Judge Mahan's Sataquoi Bay Snapdragon case and says, hey, the servicer can bring on behalf of the enterprise and the agency. Relies and cites to Skylight. Skylight, the Skylights case by Chief Judge Navarro actually had an enterprise agency involvement. Chief Judge Navarro in Green Chief versus Collegium stated and distinguished those cases and said because the agency isn't here, and let me be really clear as to what
she denied summary judgment. You're here defending summary judgment.
Correct.
There's a big difference.
Yes, Your Honor, but remember, summary judgment, at this point, the only evidence they brought of anything, which the judge acknowledged there was a problem, that there was a dispute as to Freddie and NationStar's contract. There was no evidence of
as Justice Hardesty read earlier, finding number 12, it's like, even if they did, it's like it doesn't matter.
Because they don't have, and let me look at it again to make sure that I answer you correctly.
Number 12 recites both Freddie and the agency.
And I think what this goes to then is their prudential standing. But if there was no claim here, and even if that part was wrong, there is no claim here. Let's go back to what we have in this case. No claim here that FHFA has a contract. What's happening here, if you go back to the statute and back to what's being claimed, is who did Congress give authority to? And they gave authority to the agency.
Well, but that takes us full circle to the point I was trying to raise in the earlier question, and that is that extended? Should that be viewed more broadly in light of the CFR that I asked you about? Which allows the agency to contract with contractors to assist it in fulfilling its duties.
Well, and then we have the problem, Your Honor, hypothetical that's not before us. And while the judge said that it wouldn't allow FHFA, there are no facts or intentions that there is an actual contract directly to FHFA.
Well, it sounds like on this point, on NationStar's standing, the way the judge phrased number 12 in the order, it didn't matter. They would have no standing even if there'd been a contract. And that's problematic to me.
And here's, and I understand that, Your Honor, and
maybe they can't produce a contract.
I truly understand your concern regarding that. And to that, I would say that the ability of an agency to assign its power and authority is pretty prickly. And it has a lot, there's a lot of, it's pretty contentious as to whether or not they can't even do that. And it goes beyond what actually has been argued here. But
so you're saying even if there was a contract, it doesn't matter as far as you're concerned?
I believe that it would bring different defenses. If there had been evidence of a contract, there would be different defenses, different arguments that would have been raised below. In other words, the extent to which an agency can delegate its authority and its or its powers to a private entity, if at all, is a controversial issue, involves things that haven't been briefed here, and are not before the court on this record.
Ms. Gilbert, can I ask you one other question? I know we spent a lot of time on this contract issue and standing. Sure. Mr. Eisenberg said that NationStar didn't get any notice of this sale by the HOA and therefore didn't have an opportunity to object or do anything regarding the sale. What's your position on this?
Actually, Your Honor, what the record shows is that they said they had no evidence of the notice there, and there was no evidence of the mailing. Interestingly, in the brief, they never argued that they did not have that notice, or they did not have actual notice. The notice was mailed to Banna. If you remember, Banna was the owner of the note.
I'm sorry, who was it mailed to?
Banna.
Banna, okay.
And if you remember, Banna is the owner of the note in this case.
So in the deed of trust, it's recorded in Clark County, it shows the beneficiaries Banna and not NationStar.
No, NationStar was there was a second assignment of the deed of trust to NationStar, and there was not notice there. And to the extent that this becomes an issue, it would have to return to the district court for some, perhaps for some more balancing. What the district court determined was that lack of notice didn't rise to the level of fraud, unfairness, or oppression. If this court disagreed on that, and because it was pre-Shadowood and needed to send it back on a Shadowood, then that would be up to the district court to go further on to that part.
Well, let me just ask you, because I know you've done a ton of these cases, don't you have to give notice when you start a foreclosure? Is you check the title, and whoever the beneficiary of the deed of trust is entitled to notice.
I would argue that, and I've argued that for 4 years, Your Honor.
I thought so.
Do require notice. The bank, however, talks out of both sides of their mouth because they said that the legislature
gave them affirmative. On the merits, if they didn't have notice and the price is, as Mr. Eisenberg represents, 11% of the fair market value, I think I heard him say that. And this case was decided on summary judgment prior to Shadowood. Would it not be fair to vacate and remand for analysis under that rubric?
Well, I would like to.
I know that.
Vehemently disagree with you, Your Honor. I can't. if it needed to go back for Shadowood analysis based on the facts that were before the court at that time, you know, based on that shadow, and then with Shadowood coming after the fact, then on that issue and that issue alone, I would agree that there might have to be a remand on.
But isn't there enough, too, on the 30B6 notice and the dispute of fact as to the contract issues, and I won't restate them, but that we've been discussing, you and Justice Hardesty and I, isn't there enough of a kerfuffle over those facts that too, should be remanded?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. And the reason I don't believe so is because the statute, 4617J3, is specific to the agency. It's specific to the agency. There has never been an allegation that there was a contract between NationStar and the agency, and for them to come back now on a remand to be able to bring in new facts like that, I think would be unfair to SFR. Reality is, I think Judge Navarro got it right. There's a lack of prudential standing when you are trying to assert the rights of a third party. And here, that's exactly what the bank, and in almost all of these cases, that's exactly what the bank is attempting to do, assert the rights of a party who is not present, who claims it would be too hard to be present, and you've heard this parade of horribles. My favorite, however, was we have we allow the day-to-day operations to go to Freddie and Fannie, who are great with taking care of financial interactions. Yet these agencies have been in conservatorship for 9 years. I don't think that they're really great at that. And that's part of the problem, is that they're in conservatorship. The agency has to take its actions. We would ask that Your Honor affirm on the standing issue, and if it needs to reverse on the other for more legal understanding.
Thank you, Ms. Gilbert. Mr. Eisenberg, you have 200 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. In my 2.5 minutes, there are a couple of very important points that I need to try to make. And the first is, Justice Kibbes, you started the counsel's argument by asking about the 30B6 witness and the impact of that testimony in the absence of the actual document. And I would point out two things. Number one, if you look at the Edelstein case, footnote 11, I usually am not able to cite footnotes, but I can in this situation. Footnote 11 dealt with the servicer's authority to appear at a foreclosure mediation. And what the court said was that the contract giving that authority would have been helpful, but not required. Not required because there was other testimony in the record that established that. And the second thing that I would suggest is that it would be a rather novel holding for this court to say that a 30B6 witness's sworn testimony on a fact without any contradiction does not constitute evidence to oppose summary judgment simply because the documentary basis of that testimony is not offered into evidence.
I think she's analogizing it to like your own answers to interrogatories. Can you use that to oppose summary judgment?
Well, they didn't. The answers to interrogatories and their responses to requests for production are in this record.
Yeah.
But what isn't in this record is anything showing that SFR made a motion to compel and suggested that those responses were inadequate in any way.
Fair enough.
The second point I wanted to make had to do with counsel's argument that preemption can only apply under Armstrong if it's it doesn't apply if it's a private litigant. The mutual pharmaceutical answers that it was a private litigant. This court's decision in Munoz was a private litigant who was asserting federal preemption. Justice Pickering, you asked whether the federal agency can act through its agents, but actually, the federal agency here put Freddie and Fannie into conservatorships, and so it assumed their property. And it was Freddie who contracted with NationStar to do the servicing. So, but it was the loan itself was owned by Freddie, and through Freddie, the federal agency that's protected by the federal foreclosure bar.
So is that a matter that would have to be determined in the district court as to whether or not there's a contract between Freddie and NationStar?
Well, as I...
The way that the issue was resolved as to standing just left a whole bunch of factual issues in dispute.
Well, Your Honor, as I said earlier, I think the record is so clear, summary judgment should have been granted for NationStar in this situation. The deposition testimony, every one of these green or red tabs, constitutes a place where she said unequivocally and without contradiction that it was a Freddie loan, that NationStar was
right, but the only aspect that she testified to, from what I can recall is that Nation Star had a system with Freddie Mac as the owners of the notes that that was supported, but she testified she didn't know when Freddie Mac acquired its interest, and she did not review any pooling and servicing agreements between Nation Star and Freddie Mac prior to her deposition because she said she trusted her system. Would that be evidence that there was some evidence?
She was, yes. She was the 30B6 witness, the person most knowledgeable. What she said was that these documents are hundreds of thousands of pages that she reviewed. Her business records, probably not printed out, but on their computer. And she determined without a question that this was a Freddie loan. And she determined that NationStar had authority to protect Freddie's lien under its contract. And that was undisputed.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson.
Thank you.
Mr. Johnson, you have a minute.
Thank you, Your Honors. Ms. Gilbert says that we need to look at the statute, and I agree. The statute grants unconditional protection to the property. If Freddie Mac, through the conservatorship, had an interest in the property, it is protected. This court thought about that in Munoz. It looked at a companion statute, FIREA. It allowed a private enterprise to invoke the protection of that statute. FIREA doesn't have a clause that says, and assignees can invoke its protection. Similarly, the FDIC statute at issue in Beal Bank, it doesn't have a clause that says, and assignees of property out of FDIC receiverships can invoke its protection. The court upheld that they could anyway. The regulation Ms. Gilbert cites is permissive. It says may, as the agency deems necessary, and of course, as the defendant here, NationStar, wasn't prosecuting or investigating the claim. Mr. Eisenberg handled Armstrong. That case says that where federal law provides the rule of decision, as it does here, courts must apply it. The holding is that the Supremacy Clause doesn't provide some free-floating independent cause of action, but no one here says that it does. Congress, by enacting the federal foreclosure bar, meant to protect the conservatorships, not to burden them with unnecessary litigation load. This court's duty is to apply the statute as written. Thank you, Your Honors.
And the court thanks Mr. Eisenberg, Ms. Gilbert, and Mr. Johnson for your excellent arguments in this matter. And this matter will stand submitted. We'll be in recess till 11:30 or a little shortly thereafter.